Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. Stressed out about a holiday gift? Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list, all in one spot. That includes some great comic book gifts, ranging from a create-your-own comic book kit if you want to do it solo, to a hands-on class for kids 8 through 12 to learn the fine art of comic book creation with a group. There's even a personalized comic book to turn your family photos into a graphic novel. There's also a spicy nuts kit and an olive-making kit if you don't like comic books, but you probably do because you're listening to this podcast. In case you haven't figured it out yet, when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches. They're high quality, unique, and perfect for the superhero in your life of any age. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/comicbookclub. That's uncommongoods.com/comicbookclub for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are doing our yearly, bi-yearly, something like that.
It would be a con if we weren't talking to Connerly.
It's our Connerly.
We're talking to Tim Seeley.
Touchy-feely Tim Seeley, as we had dubbed you, I want to say, 10 years ago when we first met you.
Yeah.
But it's great to see you, as always.
Yeah, good to see you guys.
And this is a big con for you. I was at the Jim Lee and Friends paddle yesterday.
Yeah.
And you had an announcement that you told us you've been working on it for a very long time now.
Yeah.
But they announced there's Peacemaker and Eagly. It's Vigilante and Eagly.
Yes.
Peacemaker presents.
Peacemaker presents the Vigilante Eagly double feature.
There we go. That's nice. What it is.
And this it wasn't always called that. It's been called some things, so I had to learn it as well.
This is a bridge between Peacemaker Season 1 and Peacemaker Season 2.
Yeah.
You're writing a Vigilante Vigilante story with, oh my God.
With Mitch Garads.
Mitch Garads.
The amazing artist, Mr. Miracle, and all the tons of Batman stuff. He only works with Tom King. And the joke that he was telling me was, when he first got to DC, he said, I want to work with the Grayson writer, and they gave him the wrong one, and now they finally fixed it. I want to make sure I give Mitch credit for that joke. That was his.
That's a good joke.
He made that joke, but he didn't get to say it at the panel, so I was like, well, we'll get it out somewhere.
That's where we're a joke warehouse here on this podcast.
Just to be clear, like, it's not co-writing with James Gunn. He's the story consultant on it.
Yeah, I mean, all the plots and stuff have to go through James.
Okay.
He picked, you know, when we started this, we gave him a list of ideas that we wanted to do with it. He picked the one that we ended up going with. And we have to just make sure, you know, it passes the James joke test. Like, did it make him laugh? Cool.
Wow.
We're good. So,
do you perform the scripts for him then?
Yeah. Yes. I call Freddie Stroma, and then we just work it out together. And he does those parts. I do Peacemaker. It's great.
Really good.
Yeah. But it's basically a trust-based thing where we're hired because I think we have the right voice for a James thing. So, it's collaborative. It has James' name on it. It's got the stamp of approval.
Okay.
That's great.
What do you think? I mean, like you said, like, it is a very complimentary tone. When you announced this, I was like, yeah, of course, Tim's going to write this. He's got a very similar sense of humor. But do you find you have to tweak it at all to match what's going on in the show?
Well, only so much is that this is way dirtier and way meaner and way more violent even than I usually go.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm making it more James violent, which is like, you know, I do crazy violent stuff, but I'm like, I gotta turn this into a gun thing. This has got to be inspired by Toxic Avenger and all the sort of things that James loves. So I turned in the issues 4 script, and I was like, I shocked myself.
Wow.
I have shocked myself with this one.
Yeah. What did you swatch or steep yourself in as you were trying to get more violent in that way? Yeah.
I rewatched the Peacemaker show a couple times, and so I was getting the vibe, but I noticed like so much of it is just like, the humor is actually the gory stuff, you know?
Right. Uh-huh.
So then I just went back and watched Toxic Avenger 4, I think. Is James right? 4? Yeah. Which is, I think, the most James Gunn thing he's ever done.
Ever. Yeah.
Is Toxic Avenger 4, if you've never seen it. It is like where everything after comes from.
That's so really funny. The apex of his career was then. And now he's just sort of spinning around that.
Yeah. He's like, DC, whatever. You know.
Hasn't done anything makes sense.
I was really struck by on the panel, and maybe I misheard this, but you said that you're also very inspired by the Vigilante comics, and you went back to those as well.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like, you know, the obviously the version that's in the Peacemaker show is different, you know, than the original that comes from the comics, where he's a, you know, a district attorney, and it's, you know,
right.
But the core, I think, is sort of the same. And so I went back and read all of Marv's Vigilante stuff, all of, you know, when he was in Teen Titans and all that stuff. And then we pulled all of, basically all his major bad guys, we're using them for.
Oh, okay. That's
but
awesome.
They've been James Gunnified.
Okay.
So instead of being like, you know, if the original version of Agent Chase is a district attorney in New York City, it is now a waiter in Evergreen. His villains have now been similarly upgraded or downgraded depending on your viewpoint.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure.
Instead of being like mafia guys, they're like small town crappy crime cabal. And we play a lot with sort of how badly Vigilante wants to have villains. He just wants so badly to have his own rogues gallery, but clearly part of the problem is that he and Peacemaker kill most of their villains. So he's like so excited to have this like cabal of villains. And so we use Saber and Cannon. We use those guys, which were these hitmen that were working for opposing crime syndicates. And the guy with the gun is named Saber, and the guy with the sword is named Cannon.
Good.
Okay. And that's very confusing.
Yes.
So we make sure that's part of the story. Yeah.
Now, since, maybe this is getting too in the weeds, but since DC Studios, the whole thing is like everything is part of everything.
Yeah.
When you're bringing in characters like that, there's a potential they could end up on screen someday.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
Do you have to like cast them? Do you have to clear them?
We don't have to cast them, but we definitely, one of the things Mitch and I did was we took their original designs for those characters and then some of our mafia guys, and we like thought about them as if they would have to build these in actual suits. So
right.
Saber and Cannon's costumes are sort of like Vigilante's costume and stuff, so it's not casted so much as it is like this is with, and because Mitch can do such a realistic style, we're making it look as much like it's inside the TV show as we possibly can.
It's like reality adjacent, easy to pluck out of the comic and bring
right,
to life on screen.
Exactly,
very cool, very smart.
You also have just so people know if they didn't read the news, you got the Vigilante story, and then Rex Ogle and Matteo Lally are doing the backup story with Eagly. It seems like they dovetail together. So
they
what
do.
Was the
there is a connection.
Yeah.
Well, so their story is you know is Peacemaker and Vigilante and Eagly go on a vacation together, and so their story is them traveling. In our story, when Vigilante finds out Peacemaker is gone, he assumes he's been kidnapped, but it's actually that that Peacemaker's like, I gotta get away from this guy, he's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
And then he just forgets to tell him, and then when he basically our connection to it is in issue one, you know, Peacemaker gets a phone call and he's like, oh god, I forgot to tell Adrian I'm going, and then instead of admitting he screwed up, he's like, I've been kidnapped.
Okay.
So now that leads into our story, and it's Vigilante's trying to track down the kidnappers of Peacemaker, essentially.
I don't know if this is spoiling too much at the end, but how much of a bridge is it? Does it walk us right up to Peacemaker Season 2, or is it just something between seasons?
It definitely connects from the end, and then I don't want to give too much away because of how Season 2 of the show works. There's an interesting way we have to connect it. I'll say that, yes.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, that's cool. Can we talk about Local Man for
a little
bit?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
I'm not shy about saying it's my favorite comic book. What do we have coming up for Local Man?
Nothing. Nothing's coming up for Local Man.
But there's future.
I mean, we'll do more of it. You know, so we basically, if you spoiler warnings, if you didn't know, issue 25 is sort of the last issue.
Yeah.
So we jumped ahead a year, and then the book wraps, essentially. Tony and I were working on something else, another series that we're going to do for Image, but already we're supposed to be working on this other thing. Tony's sending me all these Local Man ideas.
That's what I feel that in the air.
We got to, I think, you know, the way that we got to tell the story, it does work very well as wrapping up that version of the story.
Yeah.
So I feel good about, you know, how we did it, where we got to it. I don't feel like we left any threads that we needed to tie up, but you know, there's plenty of new threads we could pick at and unravel and do more with. So.
Now, in the note in the back of issue 25, Tony was very transparent about the financial issues that face an independent comic series.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume you have a similar take on it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the big problem that we had is that you know, Local Man, it didn't lose money.
Yeah.
But the time that it takes Tony to draw it, which is about 3 weeks, the time that it takes me to draw my part is about 2 or 3 days. And for Tony to then have to write, you know, Feral and have to, like, do all his other projects, he's got a week, a month after doing Local Man. But Local Man only makes, it's like 10% of his income. So
that doesn't quite work.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we also had the experience where we're sort of like, ah, we just can't, we couldn't get retailers to order more of them. Even though in my past experience, it was always like, you know, hey, the buzz is good. Your books will slowly rise in sales. And we got nominated for an Eisner, and that would usually, instead, retailers just never, they didn't drop it, didn't drop sales, but they just never added more, which, you know, it went against our own math of how we were going to do this. We're like, well, by this issue, we should be here. And, you know, kind of just based on our expectations with how Revival sold or how Hack Slash sold.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of it was just we have to do, there's a new economy for indie comics, which is essentially the series, as long as it's not losing money, you know, you're really waiting for the trade sales. Because that's really where, but it
where
takes
it
so long. You know, it takes like a year and a half for the first time the trade goes on sale to getting that check. So the other side of it is we decided, okay, let's wrap it up. Then we got the check for our accruals, and we're like, oh shit, it did really well.
Well, that's gotta be gratifying at the, if nothing else.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a book that, because it is so insular and kind of wraps up, it is something I think people will buy and trade.
Yeah.
And then when we do the hardcover, eventually our fancy hardcover vision that has all three trades in it, I think that'll do well too. So all those things can kind of help us lead to bringing it back. And if Rob can bring Youngblood back, we can absolutely bring
That's
Logan
inevitable.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what I feel.
I do want to ask you a spoilery question about the end of the issue, though. So if anybody listening doesn't want to know, get it, turn it away.
Tune out now.
This, to me, was the most transparent, you and Tony being like, this book is about ourselves, because it's about owning and feeling comfortable with yourself artistically. How did you hit on that as the end point?
I mean, that, you know, in a weird way, that was actually one of the first things we talked about when we were starting the book was, you know, as we get older and are making our own stuff, we also kind of feel, like, generative to some degree. We're very aware of, like, and I think it comes across in the book, that we want the next generation to come in. And part of the story has always been our nostalgia and love for things that we grew up on, balanced with the ideas we can't get lost in nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Jack becoming an art teacher, like, that's essentially, you know, us saying, like, we want, and that's how I feel personally. I teach art at a college, is that I want the next generation of comics fans to, like, be inspired, and I want them to love comics, and I want them to start making their own, and all those things that you know, that we talked about, Tony and I, when we first started the book, that had to be the ending. Mm-hmm. You know, it had to wrap up in the way that our first conversations were about what is this about, you know? So, you know, there was a version of the first script where it starts with Jack teaching at an elementary school art, and he's like a substitute art teacher, and all the little kids are like, you know, hi, I'm Mr. Xavier, and they're like, fuck Crossjack.
Yeah.
So we scrapped that version, but that has always been one of the things that we wanted to do with it.
That's cool. You know, hearing you talk about that, I feel like we met you at cons, like, truly, what, 10, 12 years ago or something. Yeah. We've been doing the show for 18 years.
No, it was longer ago than that. It was 15 years ago.
15 years ago.
16 maybe. Yeah.
And what is it like from then to now? Because that was like Hack Slash was sort of like popping off, and now you've gone through and done sort of a little bit of everything in this industry.
Really.
Are you exhausted? Are you inspired? I mean, you're probably both, but like, what does it feel like to sort of take all that in, especially as Local Man finishing and you're doing this big, new, cool book at DC?
I mean, I think it's almost always when I leave a comic convention, I feel better about comics than I did when I came in. Because it is the, you know, sitting at home and making comics by yourself and having only the connection to the internet is not going to make you feel great about about fandom and comics and where it's going. But when you're in a place and you're in a con and you see so, I mean, the diversity of this crowd is incredible, right? I mean, these are all, people of all ages, you know, generations. Every, you know, there's more women here than there have ever been at cons. Like, all the things that I think are positive in the right direction, you see it at a con, and then you're like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go home and fucking rock this shit, you know. So it does. This show is always inspiring, you know. It's like it, and it gives you a good sort of perception of how you're doing in comics when you go to the con and you see like, okay, I managed to get some new readers this way. Great, I've got here's my like unexpected audience for, you know, for Money Shot or my, you know, all these sort of things that you get to learn and do a survey of at a convention, basically.
Right. It's a big focus group.
It's a focus group. It sounds cynical, but I think it, you know, and also sort of, it tells you one of the things that you did that worked. And so going back to when I started working on Hackslash, it was the, holy crap, this is a book that cosplaying young girls like, which is, okay, great, I didn't know that. This is fantastic. Now I know this, and this helps me direct how we do things, and here's what works and here's what doesn't. And like the amount of people coming up to me at this show and saying fuck Crossjack and then walking away.
And you're like, oh, okay, that's good.
That's really cool. You could also buy something.
Yeah, right.
Fuck you. How about that?
I do want to ask you though, on the opposite end of the spectrum, but not to bring up maybe a sticky subject, but there was a lot of pushback on the Rogue series.
Oh wait, what?
The Rogue series.
Oh yeah,
which I assume is part of what you're talking about, the online reaction.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think you handled it really well, by the way, not to flush you up or anything like that.
Yeah, sure.
But what's it like when you get that sort of reaction, that sort of pushback online?
I mean, this one was really unexpected because the anger and that. And someone reported us to like a women's shelter for abusing.
Also, it's like, what are you doing? That's not what this is for.
They have real people they have to deal with. You're wasting their, you know. So that was shocking. But also, you know, the their perception why some of these fans were very angry with us was just based on incorrect information, right?
Like, right.
You know, it's the sort of idea. There's a corner fandom who loves Rogue but thinks the relationship with Magneto is icky, and that it's they're applying a lot of reality to something very fictional. But the other side of that is, if you read the original book where ours takes place in between, they don't have a romantic relationship yet. So by design, I'm not going to get to that part of the story. That comes many years later. So it was like a very passionate reaction to something that's not true. It's not, you know. So it did, once people realized, like, that's not what we're doing. It would be okay if we did it, but that's not part of the story. It inherently can't be. So, you know, if we're dancing between the raindrops and we're trying to take this very seriously as a sort of interstitial story between these, it doesn't have that relationship, so don't worry about it, you know?
Yeah.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, you mentioned Money Shot. You've got a little bit of an exchange program going on with work that you did on Minor Threats, where it's Patton Oswalt just coming over and helping out with that. What can you tell us about
And that was great, because we worked on, I know Jordan Bloom is his collaborator on Minor Threats, and so I've knew Jordan. Jordan was actually someone we talked about if we're doing some Money Shot stuff for live action animation. So, but so he introduced me to Patton, and we were working on. We had a great time working on alternates, Minor Threats, but I kind of in a half jokey ass way at some point, I was like, we should do something together, you know. And Patton was like, yeah, man, what do you want to do? And I was like, I'm gonna make you write your Money Shot. I thought I was joking, and he was like, okay, I would love to do that. I was like, wait. You want to write Money Shot? He's like, I would love to. It's one of my favorite comics. Like,
that's so good.
Okay. So we just been working. We toss back ideas. We develop the plot together. I write a draft. I send it to Patton. He makes it much funnier because that's what he does. And then we end up with something that's kind of a new take. You know, it's like a slightly different vibe than earlier kind of my attempts at being funny. And now it's a different kind of funny. But it's also really biting a satire. This one is like our most satirical one yet, I think.
Cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
So.
That was obviously a lot of stuff. Anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, Jesus. I mean, I knew, like, building up to this show, I was like, please don't have all the books that I've been working on for the past year get announced at the exact same time, and it was like one after another. I was like, God damn it.
Yeah.
It's like, it looks like all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh, Sealer writes like 8 books a month. It's like, well, that one's been done for a while, and this one I'm just, so the timing, it looks like I'm fucking insane. But
but you're not.
I mean, clearly not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely not. Not. The more you say you're not insane, the more everyone knows
right,
you're not.
Right, exactly. But yeah, so I have a book at in the Spawn universe with Joe Illidge. I have some more X-Men stuff I'm doing, the Astonishing X-Men, which is a online stuff. And so plenty to keep me busy, for sure, yeah. And Master Universe Turtles stuff, all that. Lots of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and I love that. I thought that was such a fun... You talk about funny. Like, that book's very fun and funny.
It's like you can't not make a Ninja Turtles and He-Man team up fun. It's inherently so goofy, you have to do it.
Well, but I feel like you could... A lot of people go the other way and make it weirdly serious, and I'm like... When I opened, I was like, oh, great, because there's so much serious taking of things. I'm like, this was ridiculous so long ago, and it's only more ridiculous now.
Well, right. But at the same time, there's that scene you do where... Forgetting
Donatello,
And Splinter connect before that portal closed.
It was very emotional as well. Yeah.
Well, I feel like that's such a the thing that I wanted to do with that one was the thing that ties them together. It's both stories about teenagers with adult responsibilities. That's what Turtles is about, right? They're just trying to be kids, and they have to do this. And that's Master Universe too. Prince Adam is a prince who is a teenage kid, and he turns into a guy who looks a lot like himself. But is older and tanner.
Can't crack that case.
Yeah.
The tanning is the part you got to really wonder. When does the tanning happen?
It's like, well, that energy just cooks him right up, you know? But I mean, the thing that I connect to in any story is, what is this really about, you know? So that's the thing that connects Master Universe and Turtles is it's that overall theme. So I play it even more later. Yeah. And, you know, we'll get like the mentor... relationship between Man-at-Arms and Michelangelo and the mentor sort of relationship between Splinter and He-Man, which is things I can't believe I'm saying, but they are big parts of the story, you know? So I really wanted to make sure it's emotional and touching as well.
Awesome.
So cool.
Tim, thank you so much for catching
thank
up.
You.
We'll, I guess, chat with you at the next con.
Yeah.
All right. And we're sitting in Will's Portacio's booth.
Yes. He's not here.
Look at that.
Oh, he's very mad right over there.
My God,
he's so mad. He's so mad.
He's coming.
And if you'd like to support our podcast, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.